to form the macrostructure you want. McClintock nonchalantly waved one hand in the air. We can get that information for you. The woman looked doubtful. As I understand it, optical glass consists mainly of silicon and oxygen, but there are plenty of minor constituents, too. And they can be critical, isn't that so? McClintock turned to Grant. Is that right? Grant said to the screen, The glass is of borosilicate. About 10% is boron oxide. And you're right, there are other constituents as well. And you are? The woman asked. Before Grant could reply, McClintock said, This is Grant Simpson. He's the head of my technical staff. My technical staff, Grant thought. The ulcer would pucker his sphincter over that. I'm Chris Cardenas, the woman said with a warm smile. I'm very pleased to meet you, Dr. Cardenas, said Grant. Call me Chris, and I'll call you Grant. Okay. With just the hint of a frown on his chiseled features, McClintock said, You can get Dr. Cardenas a detailed list of the ingredients in the optical glass we use for the mirrors, can't you? Grant started to answer, but Cardenas interrupted. If you can simply give me a few samples of the glass, I can program a set of nano-disassemblers to take them apart atom by atom. That'll give us the exact specifications we need. Disassemblers? Grant asked. You mean gobblers? Cardenas' face went cold. Disassemblers, she said flatly. I use them in my lab here for analyses. They do not get outside of my lab, and even if they did, they are programmed to shut themselves down at a fixed time limit. The area can also be bathed in high-intensity ultraviolet light, which deactivates the nanos quite thoroughly. There's no need to worry about gobblers getting loose. Okay, okay, Grant said, raising both his hands in a gesture of surrender. I'm not a nano-Luddite. I'm not scared of nanomachines. It wasn't exactly true, he knew, but close enough. McClintock soothed. Of course not. That's why we're asking for your help, Dr. Cardenas. She dipped her chin a notch in acknowledgement. Now then, McClintock went on. Once you know exactly what the ingredients are, how soon can you produce a 100-meter mirror for us? How soon can you gather together all the necessary raw materials? McClintock shrugged elaborately and turned to Grant again. The glass is actually manufactured in Cellini, Grant said. They ship it here in chunks, and we melt it down at our mirror lab. Then I should talk with the people at the glass factory, said Cardenas. I suppose so, McClintock said. But once you have the raw materials, how quickly can... Cardenas interrupted. 100-meter mirror? To what tolerance? Grant answered. It's got to be curved to within a fraction of the wavelength of visible light. Woof! That'll take a bit of doing. We spend months polishing the surfaces to the correct figure, Grant said. With a trace of a smile, Cardenas said, If you can give me the exact specifications, my little guys ought to be able to do it in a week or so. Maybe 10 days on the outside. A week? McClintock gasped. On that order, she replied. That would be fine, McClintock said, grinning at the screen. Wonderful. Grant added, I'll talk to the head of the glass factory, tell him to give you a few samples of the optical glass they make for us. And I'll get on this as soon as the samples are in my hands, said Cardenas. You'll handle this personally? McClintock asked. Cardenas gave him a rueful little smile. I don't have much of a staff here. Yes, I'll make room in my schedule to handle this myself. Fine, McClintock repeated. Just fine. Thank you, Grant said. Cardenas smiled again, warmer this time, and said, That's it, then. I'll call you again when I get the glass samples. Goodbye. McClintock said, Goodbye for now. The screen went dark. McClintock turned to Grant. I want you to get over to Cellini and see to it that she gets those samples with the speed of light. I don't think that's necessary, Grant said. McClintock's expression went stony. It doesn't matter what you think. You get your butt over to Cellini now. Grant fought down the flash of anger that surged through him. I'll have to clear it with Ulrich. I'll take care of Ulrich. You get yourself moving. But no buts. I know about your work history, and I know about your drug habit. It's not a drug habit. Medications, then, McClintock amended easily. I don't care. Can you understand that? I don't give a damn what you swallow or inject into yourself. As long as you perform your job well, you can fill yourself with all the designer drugs you can get your hands on. Grant glared at him. McClintock broke into his handsome smile again. Don't get so tense, Grant. We're going to get along just fine, as long as you do your job. Easing back on the sofa, he added, You do the work, and I'll take the credit. Deal? Grant said to himself, Another one. Just like Nate. At least he admits it openly, though. To McClintock, he grudgingly muttered, Deal. Dossier. Grant Philip Simpson. For his 8th birthday, Grant Simpson received a small Rubik's Cube from his favorite uncle. Fascinated, Grant spent hours doggedly trying to rotate every facet of the wickedly intricate device until he had all the colors properly lined up. He stayed up late for 2 nights in a row, hiding under his bed covers with a flashlight, until at last he had solved the puzzle and each side of the cube showed one color only. Proudly, he brought the cube to school and showed it off to his classmates during their lunch period. One of the boys asked if he could try it. Grant scrambled the facets, then gave the cube to him. Before the next class began, the lad handed it back to Grant, grinning broadly. He had solved the cube perfectly. Grant felt utterly stupid. What had taken him days and nights to do, his classmate had done in less than an hour. It wasn't until the end of the school term that the boy revealed, with an even bigger grin, that he had simply peeled the colored plastic stickers off the device, then pasted them back on in the proper order. From that shocked moment onward, Grant Simpson loathed the idea of using trickery instead of earnest hard work. He expected people to do their jobs honestly, the way he did. Grant always worked hard at whatever he attempted. Sometimes he tried too hard. He came to the moon from his home in Johannesburg, barely one step ahead of a lynch mob of South African police detectives, lawyers, and media pundits who heartlessly held him responsible for mass murder. All because he wanted to help the neediest of the needy. The greenhouse warming had struck suddenly and disastrously all across the earth. After more than a century of a barely perceptible rise in global temperatures, the Earth's climate reached a tipping point. Within little more than a decade, ice caps melted, sea levels rose, coastal cities worldwide were flooded, farmlands parched, and devastating storms stripped millions of families of their homes, their livelihoods, their hopes for the future. Young Grant Simpson, clasping a brand new degree in civil engineering, had dreamed of going to the moon and helping to build lunar habitats for the newly independent nation of Selene. He had applied for a job permit at Selene and been accepted. You can build new cities right here, his stepfather had insisted. God knows we've got enough homeless coolies pouring into South Africa. Blacks, Arabs, even refugees from Israel. Can't keep them out. They need shelter almost as much as they need food. His stepfather was a blustering shopkeeper who bullied Grant's mother and everyone else around him. But although Grant would not be bullied, he still recognized the truth behind the old man's words. He saw the need in the weary, frightened eyes of the helpless, homeless, hopeless immigrants. Grant tried. He tried very hard. He set aside his dreams of working on the moon and took on the task of building housing for the desperate, bewildered people who had lost everything. The only challenge in the work was to get the units built faster and cheaper, always faster and cheaper. Grant warned his superiors that they were taking too many shortcuts. They ignored him. He went to the construction company's management, and all that earned him was their cold disdain and the active hostility of his fellow workers. "Don't get yourself all lathered up, Grant," his supervisor told him. "We're building for dumbass migrants, not the royal family, for Christ's sakes." Offended by his co-workers' slipshod efforts and incensed even more by their careless attitude, Grant found himself isolated, friendless, alone in his fears that their sloppy work would lead to disaster. When the company's latest and shoddiest apartment block collapsed, killing 73 sleeping men, women, and children, Grant got blamed. Somehow the company's records showed that it was Grant Simpson.